coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The new Public Education Funding Commission recently met for the first time, and there's already questions about how long it will take to do its work.
Frankly, I can see this process dragging out for 2 years. I can see it possibly going longer than that.
Contributor Larry Nightingale examines the latest efforts to address education funding in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have a candidate conversation with the Republican running for insurance commissioner. Plus, Arts Playlist previews the Biggs Museum's final exhibition of the year, and Enlighten Me explores the link between social media and belief in the paranormal. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned in to a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Education funding remains a front burner issue in the first state, but how it will be addressed and how quickly remains up in the air. Last year, the state received an independent report recommending it spend from $600 million to $1 billion more annually on education and revamp its education funding system. Earlier this year, lawmakers created the Public Education Funding Commission to examine the report and offer its own recommendations on how to proceed. That group met for the first time last month. And contributor Larry Nightingale reports there are already questions about how quickly it can do its work and provide a path forward. Larry's piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss the start of this latest effort to address education funding in Delaware.
So let's start with diving in on why this commission was actually created to begin with.
Okay, so let's do a quick history lesson here. Delaware now uses a school funding system that was created in the 1940s, and Delaware's three counties had gone since the 1970s and 1980s without reassessing property values. So, in 2018, a lawsuit was filed, and that lawsuit alleged that inequities in the state school funding system resulted in certain groups of students, low-income children, English learners, and many who are in special education programs, were not receiving an adequate education because of the funding system. Now, that suit was settled in 2020, and one of its outcomes was the property reassessments that are underway now in all three counties. Another outcome was the requirement that the state hire consultants to write what's known as an independent assessment of how it should improve its education funding system. Now, that report was completed last year, and earlier this year, the General Assembly created a commission to consider how to implement the report's recommendations.
So with that in mind, the next question is, who exactly is on this commission to make these decisions?
Well, actually, it might be easier to tell you who isn't on it. But seriously, there are 31 members, and the General Assembly managed to include representatives of just about every stakeholder group imaginable. We've got legislators from both parties, including the chairs of the House and Senate Education Committees. We've got school board members, district and charter school administrators, teachers, counselors, a paraprofessional. Then there are leaders of advocacy groups that support parents of low-income children, special education students, and English learners.
So that group had its first meeting last month. And let's start where the commission started. The independent AIR report, that independent report you mentioned, that produces a byproduct of the 2020 settlement of the education funding lawsuit against the state. Is the commission looking at that as a blueprint or a starting point for its work?
Yes, that AIR report will be both a starting point and a focal point of the commission's work, which is supposed to be, and I quote from the resolution, a comprehensive review of public education funding for all students and populations, end quote. The commission is supposed to study all of the report's recommendations, and those recommendations include spending more money on education, distributing resources according to student needs, implementing a new funding formula, giving districts and charter schools more flexibility in how they spend money, simplifying the funding mechanism for charter schools, and expanding pre-kindergarten programs.
But this isn't just about considering the AIR report. What are some of the other things the commission is tasked with reviewing as part of its work?
Well, correct. The reviewing the air report is just a crucial starting point. Whatever the commission comes up with is also supposed to do these things: support student achievement, promote recruitment and retention of staff members, address wealth disparities and inequities among students in both districts and charter schools, and make sure that pay scales that exist now aren't negatively affected by whatever they develop, and whenever the reforms take effect, make sure that no district or charter school gets less money in the first year than what it would have received under the current formulas. There's more, but there's no point in getting too deep into the weeds today.
And with that in mind, let's talk about some of the immediate issues that emerged as the commission is getting started, and kind of one leads to the other. We'll start with the first, which is that it's choosing the direction this commission is going to take with the state funding formula. What's the decision that they've got to make, kind of get this whole ball rolling?
Well, when the commission held its first meetings last week, the consultant who's been hired to guide these sessions used a construction analogy to make it a little bit easier to comprehend. Do we want to build a new house or remodel the one that we have? Translating, create an entirely new funding formula or make more changes to the one that we've been using for the last 70 years. Now, folks who have been pushing for funding reform advocate building from scratch, using formulas that are based on individual student needs. And this is a path that many other states have taken. But some people prefer keeping the current framework, saying it makes funding more predictable from year to year, but adding more funds to support those students who have the greatest needs.
So this decision and the concern over making it kind of leads to our second issue, which is timing. There is already some concern this group won't be able to deliver its recommendations as required by this time next year, October 2025. So what's fueling those concerns with, you know, actually getting the work done?
Well, first of all, the commission has a schedule now of two-hour meetings once a month for the next year. Now, members are going to have a lot to examine and decide in those meetings, and that's going to mean that they're going to have a lot of homework to do in between each of these monthly sessions. And frankly, they're not sure at the outset whether they're going to be able to get it all done. So now let's circle back to that last question about whether we create a new system or remodel the current one. The consultants were pushing to have the commission make that decision quickly, so that way they would have more time to actually assemble the new system or the remodeled system and move forward with it. But some of the members of the commission pushed back. They said they want to have more time to examine the pros and cons of each approach before they make a decision, because they want to be confident that the path they choose is the correct one before they start working out the details.
And this leads to an issue that we've often heard about before, and that is a lack of urgency. For context, the education law funding lawsuit, as you mentioned, was filed in 2018, settled in 2020, air report delivered a year ago in 2023. Now this commission says it may need more time, more than a year, to get the work done, meaning the recommendations sometime in 2026 perhaps. That means a child in kindergarten when the lawsuit was filed will be on the cusp of high school when the recommendations are delivered, and that would still leave crafting and passing legislation and implementing it. Was there much talk in the first meetings last month about the need for urgency and staying on the timetable?
Well, yeah, what you're saying is right on point. And from some of the things that we heard at the session, you know, it could be even worse. At last week's meetings, the consultants mentioned a couple of states that are now phasing in new funding formulas. And they're doing it so slowly that the full impact of the new systems that they're implementing aren't going to take effect until some kids who weren't born when the changes were made are actually graduating from high school. Kendall Massett from the Delaware Charter Schools Network raised this issue of urgency during the brief public comment period at the end of the session's second meeting. Now, also, if you go back to last year, leaders of the Delaware chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, which was involved in filing the lawsuit, said that they would be ready to go back into court if the state delayed carrying out the terms of the settlement. We've got some action here, you know, some work in progress. So whether that means they're carrying it out or not, we can discuss at length. But in any case, we've got people who want this issue resolved quickly, and they want significant changes to the funding formulas. And we've also got people who are cautiously saying that we want to do this right and we need more time to do it.
So with all that in mind, the commission meets again in about 10 days. What can we expect from that meeting on determining the next steps?
Well, you know, before that October 14th meeting, the chairs of the General Assembly's education committees, Senator Laura Sturgeon, who was actually the chairman of the commission for this year, and House Representative Kim Williams, who is going to be the chair next year. They've got this odd even years thing written into the resolution. They're going to be talking with Secretary of Education Mark Holodick about the details that would relate to possibly extending the contracts of the consultants that have been hired to guide the commission's meetings. Of course, if the commission thinks it's going to need more time than is spelled out in the legislation, then they're going to need contract extensions to keep this thing going. Now, anyhow, if that's the case, the commission is probably going to spend some time at its October meeting about talking about asking the General Assembly to modify the timelines and the resolution that created the group. And in addition to that, we can expect that this October meeting is going to include a lively discussion about this issue that we've talked about today, whether we're going to build a new formula or remodel the current one.
All this, of course, comes as the general election looms and the state prepares for a new governor. Is that change in administration likely to have an impact on this whole process?
I'm going to say yes, but, you know, the impact here is more likely to come in the form of impressing a sense of urgency on the commission rather than expressing preferences for a specific type of reform. Let me explain that for a moment. Governor Carney, who is soon to become the mayor of Wilmington, pretty much delegated any of the follow-up on the funding assessment report to his Secretary of Education, Mark Holodick. Now, in your interviews with our gubernatorial candidates, Republican Mike Ramone and Democrat Matt Meyer, both of them expressed some support for funding reform. Ramone said that Delaware has, and I quote, the most complicated funding system in the nation. And Meyer said that the unit system that was devised in the 1940s just doesn't make sense in the 21st century. So whoever's going to be elected will be pushing for a change. But the governor's responsible for appointing only two of the 31 commission members, and 18 of the 31 members of that commission are educators or representatives of education groups. In other words, we've got a lot of vested interests involved here. So if our new governor wants to have an impact on this commission's outcome, he's going to have to make his preferences known, loud and clear, and then he's going to have to hope that community influencers who share his views make their views known, make their voices known to the commission, and impress upon the commission the importance of moving in a particular direction.
So as we wrap this up, it's still early in the process, but how do you see this playing out? It's a big question, probably a tough question, but I'll ask it anyway.
Well, and you know from past experience that I tend to be a little bit of a skeptic on these things. My concern here is that, frankly, I see a little bit too much of the old Delaware way tradition at work here. You know, you're putting 31 people in a room and you're expecting them to solve the problem. Now, first of all, in my humble opinion, I think the group might be a little bit too large. Also, the advocates for the kids who have the greatest needs, those low-income English learners, special education students. The number of advocates there are too few, and they're also the least knowledgeable in the area of school finance. The people who know the current system the best are probably, not necessarily, but probably the least likely to want to change it. So, I mean, frankly, I can see this process dragging out for 2 years. I can see it possibly going longer than that, and I can see it resulting in some kind of a hybrid system that looks like reform but doesn't do enough to resolve the inequities that exist today.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece on the Public Education Funding Commission and the future of education funding in Delaware is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next up, we head back to our Candidate Conversations series to hear from the Republican running for insurance commissioner. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This week, we return to our Candidate Conversations series ahead of November's general election, specifically the race for insurance commissioner, where we now hear from the Republican running, Ralph Taylor. Taylor is making his first run for statewide office. He twice ran for the State House of Representatives in the 31st District as a Democrat, losing Democratic primaries to State Representative Sean Lynn in 2014 and 2018. Taylor previously was elected to serve on the Capital School District School Board and Dover City Council. A reminder, the candidate conversations you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. There have been substantial increases in auto and home insurance premiums recently. For you, what role do you see the insurance commissioner playing to address those increases in costs? Obviously, the insurance commissioner doesn't set those premium costs, but what role do you see in perhaps the insurance commissioner being able to help people with these kind of rising premium rates?
I think what we're going to have to really do is turn to our subject matter experts. There's 100 insurance subject matter experts there. So what we would do is we'd sit down with them first. We'd start with the end in mind. What does it look like with insurance being super reasonable? And then we start moving towards that goal. How do we get there? We all talk about the vision. We all add to the vision. And then we train the subject matter experts to the vision. And then we strategically place them so that they can work within their strength within the vision. And then we bring everybody together at least once a month. So we start from within. Now, one of the very first things we would do with that vision is we'd have a summit. I've been talking to insurance companies, brokers. We'd have to have a summit because they have to understand that this is not sustainable. 55% increase in car insurance from January 1st of 2021, this is not sustainable. Make them understand that the number one reason for underinsured motorists and uninsured motorists is the cost. But you also have to look at it from a different perspective because I'm a business owner as well. What they're saying is that, look, Ralph, we have franchise fees. We have exorbitant wages. We have rents and mortgages. We have electricity that has to stay on. We have sewer costs. And the costs are only going up. So I can't lower my price. So again, it seems like we're in a catch-22. But I believe we as Delawareans can figure this one out, Tom. I don't think we need to think about making America great. Let's start with Delaware. Let's make Delaware great. And let's show everybody that we can do this ourselves. We don't need federal government in here doing these things for us.
So let's talk a little bit about another issue that has started to become a bigger issue in insurance and in general, and that is technology and how it intersects with things like the insurance industry, from data breaches to the use of AI and the potential of bias in the use of AI. How big an issue do you see that as being?
It's huge. When I was chair of safety advisory and transportation with the city, cybersecurity was one of my top concerns. Right around that time, Georgia had just gotten hijacked, Atlanta, I'm sorry. And it cost them millions to be able to get their information unlocked. So we were looking at it years ago with City of Dover, and it's huge. If you look at AI, where it's progressed to right now over those few short years, the cloud uses, the metadata, and how things are being mined, and it's huge. Training, because it's ever-evolving. So since it's ever-evolving, you have to have the infrastructure in place to evolve with it. I would personally add a whole new team. If I could bring in a team of these young, intelligent people and help them have them help us older folks how to navigate this, because let's face it, we don't know what we don't know in a lot of these areas, but they do. I'm a firm believer in accountability, Tom. And one of the things that I would say is that if an insurance company gets hacked and our data is stolen, your data, my data, and it's being sold on the dark web, which a lot of them are being done, I believe that LifeLock and all these other companies that have preventive measures in place, I believe the insurance company should have to pay for that. We shouldn't have to do that. It was their data that was stolen. It was their breach because maybe they aren't using technology at its fullest. Perhaps they're trying to save a couple dollars in that particular area and exposed all of us. I think that has to stop. Accountability is huge, and they need to be held accountable.
I want to talk about insurance and climate change. How do you feel Delaware should be thinking about the potential impact of climate change on insurance in things like flooding and obviously coastal issues? Is there a role for the insurance commissioner to make sure that the state is prepared for the potential impact that climate change could have on insurance rates?
Preparedness is everything. I agree with you there. I think one of the things we have to do is climate change is real. There's there's no need being a denier. So what I would propose is something along the lines of on each premium, let there be a very small percentage that goes into a coffer that would bridge the gap. I'll give you a fine example. On my wife's birthday a few years ago, tornado came through. When that tornado came through, the insurance companies did come through and started repairing homes and trees, but there was a gap. There was a gap because there were only so many adjusters. So since there's a gap, I believe that that coffer could be used to fill the gap, to make sure people have the resources that they need, some food, water, making sure that if they need to stay in a hotel, that you can do that. So I would take a small percentage of the money, maybe 1-2% of each premium, put it in a coffer, and when we do have a weather event, we're ready. But Delaware doesn't have the weather events that a lot of other states have. So again, that coffer should be able to grow exponentially in a short period of time. And who knows, maybe at some point we just cut it off because we use that as a reserve and we don't need to keep taking from people. Enough is enough. So that would be the plan that I would take, that I would use.
So I've asked you about a couple of different issues. I want to kind of turn the tables and say, what are the top one or two priorities you would have for the Office of Insurance Commissioner if you were elected?
I would try to get more competition in here. I believe that as a business owner, I understand that the more competition, the lower the prices. I think it would take something – I'm not going to say as simple as, but I think it would take – a coalition of insurance commissioners who are seeing the largest amount of their citizens coming here to Delaware. And we have a coalition with these insurance commissioners, the ones we share contiguous lines with. And we figure out a plan to allow when those people come across those Delaware lines, their insurance comes with them. If there is a way that we can bring about more competition without crossing any regulatory lines, ensuring that the mandatory benefits that you get here in Delaware stay in place, ensuring that solvency issues are never an issue, ensuring that the other regulatory practices that are currently in place stay in place, understanding the issues. I mean, we have to look at the issues to be able to overcome them. And another one would end up being the risk fragmentation. And that means if the insurance company spreads out the risk amongst a lot of different individuals. So when they come across, new company comes across the line and that big pool of people, all of a sudden, new company comes, the healthy people in that pool go to the other place that's a whole lot cheaper, leaving just the people who are sick. Mm-hmm. That coffer is going to run dry. Those resources are going to run dry. So that's going to cause destabilization in the market. We don't want that. We want to make sure that things remain stable. If the goal is to lower the prices, we also have to look at the administrative aspect of it all. We have to look at are there enough providers? Are there enough networks that are going to allow these folk in? Look at the billing issues because there's going to be billing issues and audits. We have to audit like crazy because, you know, again, we're dealing with taxpayer dollars. Transparency and accuracy is a must. So, again, we look at these issues and we start understanding it's doable. We can do interstate commerce like that. It's doable.
You alluded to the idea of like kind of regulatory frameworks and making sure like, you know, Delaware was respecting all those things and anything it did worked within those frameworks. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, what is the role do you feel for the insurance commissioner to be an office that advocates for changes in state regulations and policy? Are there areas you feel like you would want to go to the legislature and say like, hey, we need to look at this and create some legislation that could help improve the regulatory atmosphere in Delaware?
I think if we all want to be on one page, let's look at the competition aspect that I just discussed. Let's look at how we can have some of these other insurance companies from other states cross Delaware boundaries and do business and do good business. Mm. We can get these insurance prices down.
You also alluded to earlier the idea of transparency. And at a time when there seems to be a stronger distrust of government, or perhaps more specifically politicians, and calls for more transparency and accountability, what role do you feel the Insurance Commissioner's Office can play and you personally can play in giving Delawareans a better sense that transparency and accountability are things that are a priority?
Be amongst the people. Be amongst the people a whole lot more. Visibility is credibility. So make sure that my office would have overtime or a budget set up so that we would send representation to city council meetings, to school board meetings, to HOA meetings, to assisted living facilities. Let's face it, my mom is 85. I love her to death. She still works 6 days a week, Tom. She hustles, man, and I got that motor. So, but to navigate the internet, to be able to do her Medicare, to be able to see the best plans, she doesn't have that ability. So we need to be amongst the people instead of them calling into a call center and then hoping everything. Let's get out there amongst them. Let's walk through this with them. Let's show them how it's done.
More specifically to the idea of transparency and accountability, one thing that has been out there in the debate has been the idea of creating an inspector general in Delaware. Is that something you would support?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oversight is something that every Fortune 500 company has. They have oversight, overseeing the oversight. I support that 100%.
Final question I have for you is a pretty specific one. There was a bill that was introduced this year in the General Assembly seeking a constitutional amendment to term limit a series of state offices, including insurance commissioner, creating a 2-term, 8-year limit. Your opponent is running for a 3rd term. So I'm asking you and I'm asking all the candidates, do you think there should be a term limit for this office? And would you commit at this point to how many terms you would serve in this office if there is no term limit on it?
I was appointed to Kent County Board of Adjustments. 1 term I did. I was elected to Capital School Board. 1 term I did. I was elected to City Council. 1 term I did. I support this 100%. Nobody should be in office in this position a decade, because we have to evolve. There are so many changes that can come about that can be extremely beneficial for all of us. But if that one person is still there with the one mindset, the one ideology, it sets us all behind. I will commit to this 1 term. If, in fact, my community wanted me to do another one, I'd throw my name in the hat. We'd do another one. After that, no.
That's Republican candidate for Insurance Commissioner Ralph Taylor. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Arts Playlist is next, with a preview of the final exhibition of the year at the Biggs Museum of American Art. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Biggs Museum of American Art is closing out the year with an exhibition from American painter Rozeal. Best known for her contemporary work, Rozeal sets herself apart through her unique style of blending traditional ukiyo-e print techniques with Japanese folklore, geisha, kabuki, and samurai imagery, along with hip-hop and black culture references. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon chats with Biggs curator Laura Fravel about Rozeal and this new exhibition.
Let's start with Rozeal. I've seen her work and some of what might be included in this exhibit, and it's incredibly distinct. So can you give us some background on Rozeal and who she is for those that don't know?
Certainly. Rozeal is an artist who grew up in the Washington, D.C. area and still lives there. She formerly went by Iona Rozeal Brown, now just Rozeal, that one-word moniker. Earned a BFA from the San Francisco Art Institute and an MFA from Yale University, and then spent a while working as a DJ in Japan. So a bit of a pivot. She's very involved in music still, but that was eye-opening to her in many ways. And this was during the 90s. There was a subgroup in Japan involved in ganguro, which was a fashion trend mostly among teenage girls trying to look like American hip-hop celebrities. So people who darkly tanned their skin, had elaborate hairstyles, trying to look like Little Kim. But to an American living in Japan, it presented as blackface. And some of her early work involved this mixing of cultures and this appropriation and trying to rethink how this was done. So she has a series called the Blackface Paintings, or A Cube for Afro-Asiatic Allegories, where she's started developing her own mythology, kind of appropriating some Japanese figures from prints by artists like Yoshitoshi, samurai geisha, and putting them in her own universe in this elaborate mythology that is very much her own. She's working on a graphic novel, but also kind of feels universal and approachable and instantly recognizable.
That is so interesting. But for our listeners out there that have no visual to go off here, how would you describe at least Rozeal's work that's featured in this exhibit? You know, her style, her color palettes, and so on.
It is bright, it is over the top, it is incredibly rich and layered. For this exhibit, we're focusing a lot on her female figures. I think there's a thread through it of empowerment and exploring the pressures and obstacles that are facing young women today and how to be their authentic selves, to build bonds through their community. There's a section of the show that focuses on that mythology I was talking about. She collaborated for a while with Benny Ninja and the House of Ninja in New York, this voguing scene. And did a performance there. So we're showing that video. We have some costumes from that performance, and then some paintings related to those characters. And each character just has so much personality, like Anime, who's one of the saplings, who are these women who have a mission and are trying to see it through despite all of the villains that come into their path. And Anime clearly is in this very sweet schoolgirl uniform. She has this little red backpack, which Japanese schoolgirls have, that has everything she needs. And she has got these headphones that are her direct connection to the deities above who are helping to guide her. Next to her is Yoshi, the warrior, who looks like a kid on a big wheel, but is just this larger-than-life badass and has a cape. It looks a bit like a quilt. It's made up of playing cards with different kind of hip-hop slang, things like dope, keep it real. But so much of that has been commodified in American culture, and Rozeal is trying to take that back in a little bit. And in a pattern that's also reminiscent of quilts used for communication during the Underground Railroad. So, just these incredibly layered, rich images, the more you look at them.
So there's clearly a lot to sort through here with Rozeal. There's a lot going on in a given piece, a lot coming at you, a lot of themes, but it all seems to be communicated so clearly and distinctly. You're much more immersed in this world than I am, Laura, but I can't recall or think of any other artist creating anything quite like what Rozeal is creating. What are your thoughts there? And if there's anything similar to Rozeal that comes to mind for you?
I can't think of anything else quite like her work. And it is, to me, rewarding to look at that. I've been working on this show with her for a few months now. And I am continually noticing new references that she built in that just went by me the first time. Things like quotes from Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, quotes from Erykah Badu songs, because there's some text mixed in with the images as well. And I'll tell you a story for when I first started in museums. And this was my first exposure to Rozeal. But I was training as a docent, and they gave each of us novices a group of high school students and threw us into the gallery in a room that was newly installed that we had not seen before and just said, go talk about a work. And I saw a piece by Rozeal on the wall and just kind of gave the sigh of relief of, okay, we've got a lot to talk about as a group. We can unpack this together. And instantly, every hand shot up of people who wanted to talk about this. And I think that's representative of Rozeal's style.
Yeah, that says a lot, and it's a good lead in to my next question because I'm curious, what's it been like to work with someone like Rozeal in getting this installed? Obviously, for you personally and professionally, this is a full circle moment in ways, but she's been around, been doing this at a high level, so to speak. She's in her own distinctive artistic lane. She's experienced as they come. This exhibit is what, 2 decades in the making as well, or nearly 2 decades in the making. And she just seems like a fairly unique person. So, what's it been like working with her on this and in getting this exhibit installed?
It's been exciting. Ruziel's been developing these characters since 2007, working up towards a graphic novel. We've been working both with her and with Keys Art, the gallery that represents her. And the show has some loans from private lenders, some older works, but also new work, and then a little nerve-wracking for a museum, but also I think will be fabulous to watch. Very new work. We're going to have her painting on site. She has some works that are in progress that we're going to have in the final gallery of the show, and she's going to be finishing those in December, January, and February towards the end of the run of the show, and will be in the gallery answering questions from visitors, so people have a chance to interact with her too.
So this might be the last exhibit for the Biggs, but the Biggs still has so much going on in that respect. What you touched on this a bit though, but what are some pieces or maybe some other pieces or parts of the exhibit that jump out at you personally?
To me, what really jumps out is the characters themselves. And I mentioned a little bit about the video. It's called The Battle of Yestermoor. And the costumes for the show, which are these layered kimono pieces with wigs, scarves, elaborate headdresses, and seeing those characters come to life, but also the myriad of ways they're coming to life. So there's not only the costumes, but in the same gallery, we have, she's created some little action figures almost, these 3D printed things that are small and look like you just want to pick them up and handle them. But these characters that present in a variety of ways and kind of poking fun at how so many superheroes have been commodified to the nth degree in the US. So I think as you go through the show, you'll start to recognize some familiar faces and get to know these characters.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this is indeed the Biggs' final exhibit of the year, and what a way to end things, I might add. The Biggs is going out with a bang, certainly, but what's the timeline look like for this exhibit?
This is going to be on view from October 3rd of this year through March 2nd of next year. So you'll have a
Fantastic.
good chance to see it. And hopefully we'll come back and visit Rozelle on site.
Thanks to Biggs Museum of American Art curator Laura Frevel and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we finish up the green next with Enlighten Me and a look at a new University of Delaware study exploring social media use and belief in the paranormal. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us all on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Nearly half of Americans believe ghosts exist. The concept of spirits is fundamental in many cultures around the world, and they regularly show up on television, in books, movies, and folklore. This continues despite skepticism from the scientific community, raising questions about if seeing means believing. University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at the UD Center for Political Communication, sought to answer that question in a new study exploring the link between social media use and belief in the paranormal. And in this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon spoke with Brewer about the study and what it found.
I'm sure our listeners recognize you from Delaware Public Media's political coverage over the years, including our recent segment here on The Green, breaking down the Delaware primary results. But it's October, and that means Halloween, and a good time to discuss the paranormal, like ghosts and UFOs and the like. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of your study, you're someone that's as interested as anyone in this space outside of the research you've done. I know now that we're both big fans of the X-Files, so why do you decide to conduct this study specifically and look at something like the link between social media and YouTube consumption and use and the belief in the paranormal?
All right, so kind of a personal answer and then a more professional answer. Personal answer is I've always been interested in media portrayals of paranormal phenomena since I was a kid. Big Ghostbusters fan, big X-Files fan, like you mentioned. But I think it's also interesting from the point of view of looking at public opinion and media influence, because polling over the years has shown that a substantial percentage of the public says that they believe in paranormal phenomena like UFOs and ghosts, and to a lesser extent, things like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. And so that raises the question, what shapes these beliefs? Where do members of the public get these ideas, these viewpoints? And so for about 15, 20 years, I've been dabbling in studying media messages about paranormal phenomena and public attitudes and beliefs about them. And it's one of these topics that kind of comes and goes in waves. I feel like we're in the middle of a wave right now, ever since this burst of publicity surrounding U.S. government investigations into UFOs, or unidentified aerial phenomena, as the U.S. government prefers to call them. So in 2021, there was a big report that the Pentagon put out about this topic, and it generated a huge amount of publicity. And also, from Gallup polling, it suggests that public belief in UFOs went up in response to this, which raises the question, you know, can media messages help shape these beliefs? So last year, we published a study where we looked at how different forms of media use are linked to belief in UFOs. And we found that, not surprisingly, watching paranormal-themed documentaries is linked to believing in UFOs. Now, that could be a chicken and the egg thing. Do people watch paranormal documentaries because they already believe, or do the documentaries shape their beliefs? We also found some other interesting stuff, like watching Fox News is linked to believing in UFOs. And if you look at Fox coverage, they cover UFOs more than any other cable network. But one finding that we were particularly intrigued in was that YouTube use was linked to believing in UFOs. And this is not just watching YouTube videos about paranormal topics. This is YouTube use in general. That made sense to us in that there's a lot of paranormal content on YouTube. And, you know, for a lot of people, seeing is powerful. And there are a lot of, you know, videos about this. So maybe something about YouTube is particularly influential in shaping people's beliefs about UFOs. But we didn't really have a good sense of what was out there on YouTube about UFOs or other topics like ghosts. And so we did this study where we got the most popular YouTube videos about UFOs and ghosts to see what messages were out there. And what we found was that there were some really popular videos. So the average number of views for the videos we looked at, for ghosts, it was over 1 million. For UFOs, it was over 4 million. So a lot of people watching these videos. So what kind of messages were there? Well, one thing we found was that there are a lot of what we call paranormal claims. That is, suggestions that paranormal phenomena are real. UFOs are real. Hauntings are real. So most videos we looked at had those claims. Not very many skeptical claims, by contrast. Also, most videos had purported footage. So supposed footage of the phenomenon in question, so UFOs or ghosts. Not very many videos had scientific sources. More had government sources, because a lot of the UFO videos talked about government sources, you know, U.S. Navy footage of unidentified aerial phenomenon, that sort of thing. So kind of big picture here, a lot of popular videos, most of which at least suggested that paranormal phenomena are real, most of which showed videos that were supposed to be paranormal phenomena. Not many scientists out there in these videos to say, well, this isn't real, or to debunk it. So put that together, and it seems like a formula for messages that could help bolster belief, reinforce belief in paranormal phenomena. So we'd already found that YouTube use was linked to believing in UFOs. Same story for believing in ghosts. So the more people used YouTube, the more they said that they believed in ghosts and haunted houses.
What is it about YouTube and perhaps modern media like TikTok and whatnot that has the ability to effectively shape and influence people's belief in the paranormal? Is it simply because seeing is believing? The amount we're using these apps or watching video on YouTube or TikTok, or is there something more to it?
So lots of interesting questions there. And from the results it described, we can't necessarily piece together what exactly is going on. But there is other research out there, I've helped do some of it, that does show exposing people to specific messages about paranormal phenomena, maybe an image or maybe a story, can shape some messages, can bolster belief, especially messages that have credible cues, that have visual evidence, while others, you know, messages that debunk or mock paranormal phenomena can reduce belief in the paranormal. So there is what kind of messages, what kinds of audience members, what viewing or listening situations. And that's something we're still trying to explore. One thing I do feel at least reasonably confident looking at our study is if YouTube is linked to people's beliefs in paranormal phenomena, it's probably not because they're citing credible scientific sources to bolster this, because there weren't any. When we looked at YouTube, another thing that we found was that most of the videos were from traditional media organizations, a majority of them. So we're talking like the History Channel or 60 Minutes. So that might give these videos some credibility. You brought up TikTok. So that's the next phase in our project. So we are writing up a paper right now. We did another analysis where we looked at TikTok videos about paranormal phenomena, UFOs and ghosts and cryptids. And there we found some similar patterns, lots of paranormal claims, not very skeptical claims, lots of video footage, almost no scientific or government sources. But the videos were from, for lack of a better word, almost entirely from randos. We looked at almost 250 videos. There was one from the Travel Channel, and I think that was the only one from a traditional media organization. Next step would be to show people these videos, show some people one video, show other people a different video, show other people no videos, and see if watching the videos influences their beliefs, and see if different kinds of videos have different effects. And maybe also ask people, you know, in their own words, when you watch this, what do you think about this? So we expect, you know, some people might think it's just fun, some people might be believers, some people might scoff at it. So we're interested in trying to get into people's heads and find out what goes through people's heads when they watch these kinds of videos.
There's an interesting push and pull here, Paul, when it comes to these YouTube videos where this general concept of the paranormal is at least mainstream thought process here. It's rejected. But then, some of these YouTube videos are based in credible, and reliable mainstream sources. Is that's an interesting dichotomy, is it not?
It is, yes. So if you look at mainstream scientific opinion, almost by definition, mainstream scientists reject paranormal phenomena. And UFO, if you ask most scientists, they would say UFOs are not evidence of aliens visiting the Earth. There's no Bigfoot out there in the forest, that we have no evidence for ghosts. But if you look out in the media environment, I think you can find kind of, if people are looking for signals or cues about what to believe and what not to believe, like major media organizations talk a lot about this. And I think that can bestow an aura of legitimacy around these topics. People who portray themselves as UFO researchers or paranormal investigators, oftentimes, if you watch a show like Ghost Hunters, they kind of dress themselves up in, I call the trappings of science. You know, they've got their like night vision goggles, they've got the infrared thermometers, they have jargon about hotspots and e-meters, and it makes it sound sciencey. So maybe that's another source of legitimacy. And then with UFOs, you've got the federal government saying, well, we're investigating this. And you have NASA having this task force investigating this. And even if they don't say UFOs are real, or even if they debunk some reports of UFOs, just the fact that they're investigating it and major media organizations are talking about them investigating it might send a signal to some viewers, some audience members, hey, there's smoke here. Maybe there's fire here too.
Right. Yeah, and to follow up on that then, you'd say that this study, this thinking can essentially apply to, other ideas perhaps that sit outside of or at the fringes of what mainstream media deems acceptable.
Yeah, so that's part of the bigger picture for why we're interested in this. You know, I think belief in paranormal phenomena is an interesting phenomenon in and of itself, but understanding how and why media messages shape these beliefs could also help us understand how media messages shape other sorts of fringy beliefs, like conspiracy theories about things like COVID vaccines. So potentially fringy ideas with major consequences for politics or public health. If the sort of media effects processes are the same, if they carry over, you know, and some of the same people who talk about paranormal phenomena also talk about these. You know, another media source we found that was linked to paranormal beliefs was listening to Joe Rogan. So Joe Rogan talks about UFOs. Joe Rogan also talks to a lot of you know, conspiracy theorists. So maybe by understanding what media have to say and what people believe about ghosts, we can also understand some other sorts of phenomena, some other sorts of beliefs that are going on out there that could have political and public health effects.
Yes, and we are in the thick of that right now, being election season, rolling ahead to the November general election, and hearing all sorts of, you know, Springfield, Ohio, and dogs and the like. But, you know, in the spirit of this conversation, Paul, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. You know, I'd absolutely love to know any good personal experiences with with the supernatural or the paranormal. Any good stories there? Is it all just you know, what you're finding in the research realm?
Yeah, so I always get this question at the end of interviews, and so my standard answer is, so I have not seen anything that struck me as unexplained phenomena. Like, I would love to, you know, that would be fascinating. That would be great. One thing that we're actually interested in, that we've been doing some survey research on, is not only do people believe in these phenomena, but do people want to believe in them? So I haven't seen anything, but it would be fascinating to see a UFO or to see a ghost, right, or to see a Bigfoot. I hope springs eternal.
Thanks to University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to Delaware Public Media's senior producer, Kyle McKinnon, for helping make this week's show possible. For him and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.